Several years ago, a handful of Nevada scientists from the Department of Interior and one from the Nevada Department of Wildlife were able to successfully get a bill passed through Congress during the George Bush administration to dedicate water to preserving some of Nevada's wetlands. But their superiors had opposed the bill, and the assistant secretaries in Interior had even testified against it.
How did they do it? They marketed their cause. They did clandestine lobbying. They did fundraising. Their motto was, embarrass the government. Which I think is interesting because they are the government. They formed public-private NGO partnerships before this was really even discussed that much, certainly in the public administration literature, and they ghostwrote letters of protest and support.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, Rosemary O'Leary, a professor of public administration at the University of Kansas, talks about guerrilla government, how ethically or morally minded public employees can quietly or discreetly resist their superiors. That's coming up, but first, here's this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. There's a term used in the public policy realm to describe a form of dissent that is usually carried out by public employees, insiders who are dissatisfied with the actions of their own public agencies, or their programs, or the people they work for, but who typically, for strategic reasons, choose not to go public with their concerns. Rosemary O'Leary calls this guerrilla government, and she understands it better than most people. She has been researching it and writing it for years. Rosemary O'Leary is the Edwin Osteen Distinguished Professor of Public Administration at the University of Kansas, and before that, she taught at Syracuse and Indiana University, Bloomington, for 24 years prior to that. O'Leary says a few guerrilla government employees end up outing themselves as whistleblowers, but most of them do not. She says these people choose to work behind the scenes. They act from a genuine or personal sense that they are doing the right thing. For example, the Obama administration has faced this kind of dissent with the case of U.S. Army Private Bradley Manning, who secretly supplied WikiLeaks with classified information. He was convicted in 2013 for violating the Espionage Act. Rosemary O'Leary is the author and editor of 11 books and more than 100 articles and book chapters on public management, including the textbook, The Ethics of Dissent, Managing Guerrilla Government. O'Leary has served as a consultant to the U.S. Department of Interior, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, and the National Science Foundation and other national organizations. Today on the program, we're airing Rosemary O'Leary's talk, which was recorded on March 8th to a room full of University of Utah students. And I'll just say the opening of her talk is pretty dramatic.
Fire the bastard! Fire the bastard! I was 28 years old. I was director of policy and planning for a state environmental agency. All right, I'll just tell you it was the state of Kansas, where I grew up. And my boss, the secretary of the agency, called me into her office and said, fire the bastard! She was referring to one of my new employees, who was one of my best policy analysts, who did a great job during the day, but would clock out at 5 o'clock, come together with environmental advocates, and show up at public meetings at night and blast the governor for caveman-era water policies. So years later, I look back and I think, that guy was a genius. But at the time, I didn't know what to do. Brand new, pretty young manager. And my boss was telling me to fire this person. He was still a probationary employee, so we could have done it legally. This has been sort of a lifelong interest of mine based on that. I'll tell you at the very end whether I fired the bastard if you really want to know. But it's something that I've seen recurring over and over, and it's something that's affected my life and different endeavors that I've pursued. And so this became a research agenda for me. And this person was what I call a government guerrilla, which I define as career public servants who act against the wishes, either explicitly or implicitly communicated, of their superiors. So notice that I study career public servants. Edward Snowden, for example, is not a career public servant. He was a contract employee, but his actions are very similar to the types of actions that I talk about in this book. And again, this idea came from my years in government and something that I've been intrigued with ever since. So most guerrillas are not whistleblowers. So these are people who prefer to stay sort of in the closet. I used to say that they're salmon swimming upstream against the current of power. And then I had a fisherman in the audience who said, no, salmon are supposed to swim upstream. So I guess they're swimming downstream. They're doing the opposite of what we would expect them to do. They choose to work behind the scenes. They choose not to come out in the open. They choose not to be whistleblowers. And in most of the cases I studied, they were driven by policy differences and a personal sense of ethics, not corruption. Although I have presented this, I've done book talks in 8 other countries besides the U.S., and there are obviously some examples that have been brought up, and we could find many in the U.S., I'm sure, where they were driven by corruption. But the people I focus on, as far as I could tell, were not corrupt. They had a real personal sense that they were doing the right thing. So examples of guerrilla government type behavior: obey your superiors in public but disobey them in private, leak information to the media, cultivate positive relationships with interest groups, giving them information, ghostwrite letters, testimony, and studies for others outside your organization, contact elected officials, but don't tell your boss that you contacted elected officials. Neglect the policies and directives that you disagree with. Stall. Fail to implement orders that you think are unfair. File a complaint with an investigative body about your boss. Hold clandestine secret meetings to plot a unified staff strategy before you go into the staff meeting with your boss. Fail to correct your superior's mistakes. Let them fall. Some concrete examples, apologies to those of you who speak Japanese, I always butcher this person's name. I'm going to say Chiyun Sugihara was a Japanese diplomat during the Nazi era, and he was assigned to Lithuania. There's been a book about this person, there's been a really interesting documentary, but basically he was appalled at what was happening to the Jewish people in the Nazi era, and he would sign visas to get Jews out of Lithuania. He signed hundreds, and then he signed thousands of visas to get Jews out of Lithuania. The story is, and it's pretty well documented, that the Japanese government said, you must stop. You must stop writing these visas. He kept writing the visas. The Lithuanian government said, you must stop. He kept writing the visas. Finally, he was shut down. The embassy was shut down. He was physically moved to a hotel in town. He put a sign on the front of the door of the embassy that said, if you need a visa, I'm in the hotel down the street. He eventually was put on a train and taken out of town. And the story is that with this outreached arm, he signed one last visa, which was probably about his 10,000th visa, to get Jews out of Lithuania to save their lives. Chiyun Sugihara went back to Japan and died in disgrace. He had disobeyed the wishes of his superiors. He was ostracized. And then the tide turned, and eventually the Japanese people erected a statue in his honor. He's now considered a hero, but it took a couple decades for that shift in how he was perceived. I had a student when I taught at Syracuse University who was Japanese, and she said she would walk by his statue every day going to school, and that's what inspired her to become a public servant. Mark Felt. Who's Mark Felt? People my age should know this.
Deep Throat. Yes.
Deep Throat. Who's Deep Throat? Watergate, yes. Okay. So Deep Throat, the name comes from a porn movie that was popular when I was in college. But Mark Felt was the number 2 person in the FBI who outed a corrupt President Nixon. And again, this has been written up in books, it's been in movies, and the story is that these Washington Post reporters would put newspapers in Mark Felt's mailbox with a clock saying what time they wanted to meet with him in the dark parking garage down the street. If he could not meet them, he would move the flower pots around on his balcony, and he would give them tips about where this corruption was come from, and the saying, follow the money, follow the money. And the reporters eventually followed the money and exposed a corrupt President Nixon, who then resigned. A third example, the EPA employee who shows up at a public meeting and criticizes EPA policy. Didn't I just talk about that? This came from my friend Dan Fiorino, who was a career EPA employee who's now a professor at American University, and he called me up one day and said, I have a gorilla in my midst. Sorry, pun. What do I do? And he had read the book. He had a staff member very similar to the situation I started out with who was an excellent analyst, but who would just sort of take matters into her own hands once she clocked out. And then finally, this is a Maxwell grad, a Syracuse University grad, the State of California Department of Transportation employee who repairs the railroad gate against the wishes of his superiors. This alum told me I could not tell this story until after he retired. So he has retired, and I was able to put it in the book. But here he said that he noticed as he was driving around inspecting railroad tracks that there's a small town in California where the children would play by the tracks. And he was afraid for their safety, wanted to construct a gate, and went to his boss and said, "We need to construct a gate to protect these children." And his boss said, "We are in litigation with Amtrak. We're not going to give one penny to any project that would benefit that company. I'm not going to do it." But he worked his way through the bureaucracy and was able to piece together funds from different offices within his department to fund this gate that would protect children. So obviously these are, for the most part, you could spin them as positive examples. Jane Sugihara certainly was a positive example. But there are also potential negative examples of guerrilla government. If you think of a skinhead who's employed by government, who discriminates against people behind the scenes, or somebody at a place I just talked about, what about anti-choice people who might work for National Institutes of Health and change policies based on their own personal sense of ethics rather than what is the official policy. So the central thesis of my book is that guerrilla government happens all the time and that it's a manifestation of tensions between bureaucracy and democracy that will never go away. And so I always tell my public administration students that it's part of the water in which we swim, the water in which they swim, and part of the task of being a good public manager is trying to figure out, trying to navigate those tensions. This yields immense ethical and management challenges as well as harsh realities. When I first wrote this book, Don Kettle, who's now at Maryland, read it, and I thought I was writing a book about management. And he goes, "No, this is ethics. This is about ethics." And he was the one who said, "No, you really need to flesh out that part of the book." But I see it actually as having three different lenses that come together. So bureaucratic politics, those of you who are schooled in old school public administration, political science, know this literature inside and out, that bureaucrats make policy through the exercise of discretion. They are driven by their own parochial views. They seek to co-opt and can be co-opted. And they're influenced by the unique culture of their agency. So the idea is that these are immensely powerful people within bureaucracies. The literature on politics of expertise is important here. They have the capacity to initiate, innovate, sustain. And then these classic works, I really appreciate every one of them. In the 60s, The Forest Ranger. In the 70s, Hirsch's Exit Voice Loyalty. In the 80s, Lipsky's Street Level Bureaucrats. And then Norma Ricucci's work on what she calls the execocrat public administrator and policy entrepreneurs. There's also a management lens here, an organizations and management lens. So those of you who teach or are interested in the management of organizations might look at the fact that most public organizations are open systems, permeable boundaries where information can and should go in and out. This idea of organization culture, the formal culture and the informal culture within organizations. The idea of democratic organizations, giving a voice to people within organizations and people who are affected by the organization. Networks, collaborative public management. Again, the idea is that bureaucrats rarely work alone, but they work in conjunction with other people. And then ethics. I have a big shout out here to Bowman and West because they've pulled together a lot of these different lenses here recently, personal ethics, organizational ethics, and professional ethics. But then the big literature that I thought was interesting was the problem of ambiguity. In a situation like that, whose ethics counts? And how do we know when one's behavior is ethical? So Dwight Waldo was a famous political scientist who was at Berkeley for years. He was at Syracuse for years. And when I went through my PhD program at Syracuse, my mentor, David Rosenblum, called up Dwight Waldo and said, "We have a PhD student here who can only be described as majoring in Dwight Waldo." I had read everything, and it was the way that I escaped my father's law firm was by giving him Dwight Waldo books and say, no, I'm not going to practice law, even though I went through law school. Read this. This is what I think is really cool about what I'm studying. So this comes from Waldo, and he says that that public servants have 12 ethical obligations. He actually doesn't limit it to 12. These are the main 12, and he said we could go on almost infinitely. He says that public servants have an obligation to the Constitution. Now, I was just in New Zealand. New Zealand doesn't have a constitution, so this is a little U.S.-centric, but generally most countries have constitutions. An obligation to other laws within the country. Public servants have an obligation to their nation. Public servants have an obligation to democracy if they are in a democratic country. They have an obligation to their organization in which they work. They have an obligation to their profession. They have an obligation to family and friends. When I had a Fulbright in the Philippines, this was all that they wanted to talk about, obligation to family and friends. And they tied this to corruption in their government, that strong family ethic. An obligation to self, an obligation to middle-range collectives. What the heck is a middle-range collective? Anybody know? It might be whatever you're interested in, what your cause might be, whatever. So I have a sister who's an advocate for people with development disabilities. That would be her middle-range collective. Or I have a daughter-in-law who's an animal rights activist. For me, my middle-range collective is probably middle-aged women of Irish descent who like to swim. Yeah. Not very exciting, but whatever is your sense of what's important. An obligation to the public interest, an obligation to humanity, and an obligation to God. Okay, so it's lunchtime, and everybody's tired, and everybody's hungry, so what better time for a quiz? So the quiz question is, of the gorillas I interviewed, which of these obligations, ethical obligations, would they say is their number one concern? All right, let's go through this. How many of you would say it's the Constitution? No takers. How many of you would say obligation to law? No takers. How many of you would say obligation to nation? One, we got two, okay. Three. How many of you would say obligation to democracy? One, two, three, four, five. How many of you would say obligation to their particular organization? One, two. How many of you would say obligation to their profession? Most of the people I interviewed were biophysical scientists, but not all. So we've got two. How many of you would say obligation to family and friends? No takers. How many of you would say obligation to self? To thine own self be true. One, two, three, four, five. A lot of takers there. How many of you would say obligation to middle-range collectives? How many of you would say obligation to the public interest? We've got about equal number of people than self. How about obligation to humanity? And how about obligation to God? There was one gorilla who was in Nevada who was very religious, and he kept saying that this is part of being a Christian for him was watching out for the environment, and that's why he was doing what he was doing. Yeah, sure.
I understand this was developed in 1988, but my question is the obligation to God, don't we separate church and state? And these are public servants
yes.
working for the state.
Yes.
So how does that work with responsibility to God?
Yeah, good question. What Waldo was doing here was describing what he saw, what he found. Primarily in the U.S. in 1988. I think your point's well put, that there should be a division of church and state, but what he said is that the reality of this is that many people do feel an obligation to God, and that obligation might affect their choices as public servants. Okay, so thank you for your votes. I'll tell you what they told me. It was not the Constitution. It was not law, it was not the nation, it was not democracy, it was not obligation to organization, it was not profession, it was not family and friends, wasn't middle-range collectives obligation to self. Now, this is a little bit tricky because their definition of self included the public interest, policy, and professionalism. But what I, in my interview transcripts over and over and over and over, is this, I could not look at myself in the mirror in the morning. I would get up and I could not look at myself if I signed off on that report. I could not look at myself if we implemented that policy. This was something that I personally felt very uncomfortable doing. Yeah. Wait a minute. Let's get a microphone for you.
I was just going to say that with your case with your gorilla who said kind of it was God's work, that could still correlate to an obligation to self, because I think a lot of people self-identify with their beliefs in God. Kind of to answer her question as well.
Yes.
I think it kind of goes hand in hand.
Yes. I think that's right. And so those categories, I would say, are not perfectly divided. Yeah. Good point.
May I just say that my memory of Aristotle was a great quote that ethics are the thinking man's morals.
Yes. Excellent. I'm going to use that. Thank you. Thanks.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Rosemary O'Leary is a professor of public administration at the University of Kansas, and she spoke about her research into guerrilla government. According to O'Leary, guerrilla government describes situations where public employees, usually because of their own ethical or moral reasons, choose to quietly or discreetly stall or resist or even sabotage directed public policies in their organizations in defiance of their superiors. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, and we replay them, mostly in their entirety, as a public service to you. Today, we are airing a talk given on March 8th at the University of Utah. Rosemary O'Leary is a professor of public administration at the University of Kansas. She spoke about her research into the notion of guerrilla government and its role in shaping and subverting public policy.
So let me talk a little bit about my methods. This is an approach, or this is a subject matter that's been labeled the elusive subject. So these are hidden populations. They're hard to reach. They don't want to be found out. And public acknowledgement of this of them is potentially threatening. So how do you study something like this? I spent a year with Maxwell MPA students looking at the literature of how other people have studied elusive populations. So we looked at how people have studied crack dealers and how people have studied deviance in business organizations and sexual networks, HIV transmission, cigarette black markets, and employee theft. So we had to go into economics, sociology, political science, and the question was, how do you study this? We also looked at studies in business schools of workplace revenge, employee deviance, pirated goods, deception in weapons testing, unreported economy, and non-tax compliance. So the list here is here's a list of the methods that we could find, that we pulled out from this very diverse literature. And the methods that are underlined are methods that I used. So we found that people have studied this by participant observation, actually going there and observing, which I did. I went to hoedowns in Nevada, looked at fundraisers, or participated, sort of, watched fundraisers that some of the guerrillas sponsored in order to raise money for their cause. I did structured interviews, unstructured interviews, recorded stories people would tell, self-completion surveys, published sources. I did not do any lab experiments with students, and I did not look at extrapolation of indicators, because unlike tax compliance, there are no indicators that I know of. So let me go through four concrete examples that are from the book and then talk about what the pros say about this. So this first case I found out about when I was on a National Academy of Sciences panel on irrigation-induced water quality problems in the West. There were two iterations on this. I was on the second panel, and Utah actually was one of our sites. So the idea is that at the turn of the century, the U.S. decided to irrigate the western part of the U.S. to make the deserts bloom, to bring population out to states like Utah, and to allow people to grow agriculture. What scientists found out decades later was that if you flush fresh water through the desert, you also flush out other things. You flush out trace elements, you flush out pollutants. And there's a certain trace element called selenium that can, you probably know this from reading the newspapers, because it's happening right, it's happened here for years. It concentrates in the roots of plants. And if animals eat it and it's at a high enough concentration, it can kill the animals. There was a big disaster in California at the Kesterson Wildlife Refuge years ago that was caused by selenium toxicosis. So I'm on this panel, and 35 people from 35 states, 35 groups of scientists testify about this problem. And it's gloom and doom until we get to the state of Nevada, one of the very last participants to speak. And those biophysical scientists were thrilled. Senator Harry Reid had fixed the problem. Senator Harry Reid had drafted legislation to close a particular drain that was toxic on an Indian reservation, on a Native American Indian reservation. Senator Harry Reid had passed this law that would allow money to go to buy fresh water for wetlands for in the first time that it had ever been done in the U.S. And there were other smaller clauses in the bill that and they were saying, Senator Reid is a genius. Thank you, Senator Reid. So I pulled these guys over later and I said, I don't believe a word you said. I don't believe that Senator Reid knew enough about the Native American reservation. I don't believe that Senator Reid knew anything about flushing water into wetlands in order to make them healthier. I think you guys had to do this. And they're like, of course we did. Of course we did. They were elated and they were very happy to tell their story. So I made many trips out to Nevada to interview these scientists, to watch them in action. And what they ended up doing, this the best part of this story, I think, in terms of political action, is that they wrote this bill in a Basque restaurant in Reno. They even bragged that the map that ended up in the bill was drawn on a napkin in the restaurant. And then they fed it to the Environmental Defense Fund. The Environmental Defense Fund would host meetings with them in Washington, D.C. Three assistant secretaries from the U.S. Department of Interior testified formally against this bill, while at the same time, their employees on the ground in Nevada are feeding information up to the Environmental Defense Fund, Senator Reid's office, and other interest groups and legislators who were open to their idea. In the end, the bill was passed, and it was the first time that water was dedicated to the wetlands, that you could actually buy water for wetlands in the United States. How did they do it? They marketed their cause. They did clandestine lobbying. They did fundraising. Their motto was embarrass the government, which I think is interesting because they are the government. They formed public-private NGO partnerships before this was really even discussed that much, certainly in the public administration literature. And they ghost wrote letters of protest and support. A local dentist in the Reno area would tell me that, oh yeah, that see that biologist over there? He's been writing letters for me for the last 2 years, and I even give him my letterhead, and I just sign off on it.
Isn't that a lot like the petitions that go around on the internet, change.org, mm-hmm. where they have the letter crafted, and you just have to say yes, and they sign your name for it? Isn't that the newer technology? That ghostwriting.
Certainly one version of this. What was interesting about this case is that they gave information out to these people who would sign these letters before a lot of times before it was publicly revealed. So there was a lot of insider information that was embedded in these letters before it even would make, for example, the internet. Okay, the second example has to do with Ronald Reagan's presidency, the EPA regional office. Those of you who were aware of politics during when Ronald Reagan was elected know that he ran on his motto was, let's get government off the backs of the American people. He was going to dismantle or certainly slow down the EPA, and he hand-selected regional officers, not across the board, but many times whose job was to dismantle the office. So this actually comes from I became aware of this through a guy named Dick Bauer, who was the number two person in the Seattle regional office and ended up heading up the Chicago regional office. Great guy. He's a biologist from the western part of the U.S. And their concern at the time, he was one of the gorillas in this agency, was that the Seattle Regional Office would be dismantled. And they did everything they could to stop this. And the way they did it was, there was a 9 o'clock staff meeting called by the director every Monday. At 8 o'clock, all the biologists would get together to plot a unified staff strategy. What are we going to say at this 9 o'clock meeting? They filed complaints with the inspector general against regional directors. I followed them as far as I could, and I never found one where there was a finding of wrongdoing that was major. There were some small things, but I never found a big one. They leaked information to the press and environmental groups, and they failed to implement orders that they thought were unfair. To this day, Dick is probably close to 80 now, and I've kept in touch with him, and he says it still bothers him. It still bothers him that they did what they did, and yet their concern was for the environment and for their allegiance to their profession and their organization. Third example, this is the Hoosier National Forest from my days at Indiana University. This person here is Claude Ferguson, who was a forest ranger there and was appalled that off-road vehicles, motorcycles, three-wheelers, four-wheelers were allowed to go through the forest. And it was his scientific conclusion that the topography of the Hoosier National Forest could not support this. He brought the science to the director of the forest, who said, the chief officer of the forest, who said, we're going to do it. There was evidence that the head of the forest received motorcycles and off-road vehicles from the motorcycle club, and Claude Ferguson was appalled. As a scientist, he could not see that this was the right direction. So he sued his own agency in order to halt this policy of allowing off-road vehicles in the forest. He forged alliances with interest groups. He issued press releases. He rallied local community support. He wrote letters to politicians, and he encouraged newspaper articles in his favor. What's interesting about Claude is he initially lost. He was brought up basically for insubordination. There was a hearing. At the hearing, he went for a walk, and his attorney and the government's attorney cut a deal that if he resigned immediately, there would be no repercussions. He resigned. But today, if you look up whether you can have off-road vehicles in the Hoosier National Forest, the answer is no. You cannot. But it took at least a decade after Claude Ferguson's actions for that policy to become real. Last example, a newer one, a non-environmental example. Private Manning, who we all know about from reading the paper, who leaked hundreds of classified government documents to WikiLeaks. I work now with a lot of military students. I never did before, and they are sincerely appalled at what Private Manning did. At the same time, any internet search you can find, that Private Manning's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, I think, 3 times. This was the largest security breach in the history of the world. He exposed government corruption around the world, as well as petty details, triggered the Arab Spring protest. And Manning is considered both a 21st century Tiananmen Square-like hero and a crazed traitor. I believe the public sentiment on Manning is still split. In a second, in the Q&A, if you have other examples, I would love to hear them. I always learn from people who are here. But let me talk about some harsh realities that I think this idea brings to mind. The first reality is guerrilla government is here to stay. It's not, you can't stop it. There are things you can do to address it, but it's part of the water in which public administrators swim. Harsh reality number two is guerrillas can do it to you in ways you'll never know. And this came from Dick Bauer, who looked at me. He has a PhD in chemistry. And he looked at me and he goes, O'Leary, you have a generalist MPA and a PhD in public administration. Come on. If you were head of the EPA, and somebody could easily write scientific testimony for you, and you wouldn't even understand the language of it. They can do it to you in ways you would never know. Harsh reality number three, all guerrilla government is not created equal. We have the Chayun Sugihara, who saved 10,000 lives, but also we can think of very negative examples. Again, the skinheads who are anti people of color, anti-Jews, whatever, who might subvert government policy. Harsh reality number four, most public organizations are inadequately equipped to deal effectively with guerrilla government. In a second, I'll talk about my survey, and most managers I talked to said that they would probably send somebody to the personnel office or to the attorney's office, and that was it. There were basically two choices. Harsh reality number five, these tensions in guerrilla government will never be resolved. It's part of public life. So for years, because I'm a professor and we have the luxury of debating in our heads things, I asked myself, are they ethical or are they insubordinate? And one year I thought, no, they're ethical. And the next year it'd be, no, they're insubordinate. And then finally, I think, this is really sad, but I think the answer is, you know, context matters. It depends. It really depends. I then went to the National Academy of Public Administration and asked mainly, this sample size is mainly people who had at least 20, 25 years in government. And I asked them, what is the value of dissent? If you look at guerrilla activity as a form of dissent, what is the value of dissent in an organization? And here's what they told me. Dissent can yield a diversity of viewpoints. Dissent can yield positive change. Dissent can yield rigorous thinking. It could yield innovation. It could prevent catastrophes. It could create a more positive workplace. It could increase employee satisfaction. So then I asked them, well, what would you do if you had a guerrilla or if you have worked with guerrillas? And here's the advice that they gave. Create a positive organization culture that accepts, welcomes, and encourages candid dialogue and debate. Create a questioning attitude by encouraging staff to challenge the assumptions and actions of the organization. I was lucky in my career to work with NASA after the Space Shuttle Challenger incident. And one thing that I learned from Sean O'Keefe, who was then head of NASA, was he would say the most dangerous times at NASA are when they are all on the same page and they're all saying the same thing. Yes, we should fix the Hubble telescope. No, we shouldn't fix the Hubble telescope. And in those meetings, he would appoint part of the room, a portion of the room, or one person to argue against the way that they were going and tell them to vigorously take on and challenge what was being decided in the room. Because if you don't have a questioning attitude and full discussion, then you could end up going down the wrong path. Advice from the pros, number two, listen. This is where I need my prop. So the best example that I can give here comes from the US Postal Service and this idea of going postal. What do we mean when we talk about somebody going postal? Somebody's going crazy, what else? Yes, and so it wasn't too long ago that there were so to paraphrase what was just said, going crazy, shooting rampage. It wasn't too long ago that there was incident after incident after incident of violence in postal settings. And so to their credit, the U.S. Postal Service took this very seriously, and they got in there and created new policies and studied what was going on. And what they found was that if an irate worker would come in the door to talk to their manager, this is what would happen. The irate worker would say, "I am so mad! I am so mad! Lena got a raise and I didn't. I've been here longer than she is. I am so angry." And they observed the managers opening up the rule book and saying, according to rule number 275251942, you are not allowed to have a raise until you've been here for 5 years. Goodbye. And show them out the door. But the person would persist. "I am so ticked. I am so ticked. I've been here longer than she has. I have been here 5 years and I've never gotten a raise." The manager would open up a different page in the rule book and say, according to rule number 580.81, we are not allowed to discuss the personnel record of another employee. Goodbye. So what do you do if you're treated like that? You're angry, you think you're being treated inequitably. You might find a place to vent, unfortunately, your anger. So what they taught the managers to do is when somebody comes in and says, "I am so mad, Sharon got a raise and I didn't," They taught the managers to do this. Let me make sure I get this down. Let me make sure I have all the facts. Repeat the facts back to the person, and then get back to them immediately with some sort of resolution. So instead of playing tennis at the net and defending the government policies by law, they taught them to just shut up and listen. That, and then they also started a program called the Redress Program that some of you may know about, where any employee can bring their boss into mediation. Anybody. You just say, I want to go into mediation with my boss. Boom, you've got it. So if you look at the U.S. Postal Service website, they've actually documented a decrease in violence in the workplace by implementing these policies and changes in behavior. Advice from the pros, number three, understand the formal and informal organization. Yes, we have organization charts that tell us how things are supposed to work, but there's the informal organization that we all know about, who's been, maybe it's somebody who's been here longer, maybe it's somebody who can persuade people behind the scenes. Be aware of both the informal and formal so you can truly understand what people are talking about and what's going on in your organization. Advice from the pros, number four, separate the people from the problem. This is classic Fisher, Urey, and Patton, if you've read Getting to Yes. And the idea here is that if somebody is coming at you and screaming at you, I mean, if you're like me, you're probably thinking, you are such a jerk. But instead of saying, you are such a jerk, you listen to what they say and try to separate the person and listen to the problem, because the information they might be giving you just might be the canary in the coal mine telling you that your organization is about to collapse. Advice from the pros, number five, create multiple channels for dissent. So instead of just the attorney's office or the personnel office, do 360 evaluations. People in the private sector talked about hotlines, anonymous ways that people could give information. The point is to get out of your office, get around, talk to people, and get it in conjunction with personnel and the attorneys, create other avenues for dissent. Advice from the pro six, create dissent boundaries and know when to stop. And it was Sean O'Keefe who really drilled this into me. He said, you know, as head of NASA, I listen and I encourage and I want dissent, I want dissent, I want dissent. But it's sort of like a sweater and you're pulling the thread. And if you let it go on too long without making the tough decision that you get paid the big bucks for, pretty soon you'll be standing there naked in front of your staff. So his point was, eventually you have to suck it up and just make the tough decision and know when to stop, because that's what leaders do after working collaboratively with your staff, make that decision. So in closing, and then I welcome your questions, there's always somebody who thinks, maybe I want to be a gorilla. I am not encouraging gorilla behavior, something that you have to examine in your own self, but here are some questions to ask. Is the fear damage immediate, permanent, and irreversible? Are safety and health issues involved? If they are, then maybe you should be on the front page of the paper. Maybe you should be the whistleblower if there's going to be immediate action. Am I adhering to the rule of law? If you're going to take this route, you better be certain that what you're doing is legal. Are there legitimate conflicts of law? In the Nevada 4 case, there were legitimate conflicts between the laws that created the Fish and Wildlife Service and the laws that created the Bureau of Reclamation that encouraged or built a lot of the irrigation sites. Next, is this an area that is purely and legitimately discretionary? If so, maybe there is room for some dialogue and debate. Were all reasonable alternative avenues pursued? Would it be more ethical to promote transparency rather than working clandestinely? Would it be more ethical to work with sympathetic legislators before turning to the media and outside groups? Is whistleblowing a preferable route? And most important, am I correct? So let me stop there. I welcome your questions, ideas, insights, especially those of you who have read the book.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. We'll be back in a moment. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today we're broadcasting a talk by Rosemary O'Leary. She teaches public administration at the University of Kansas. She was in town a few weeks ago to talk about her research into guerrilla government. She described a few case studies of where public employees, because of their own ethical or moral reasons, choose to quietly or discreetly stall or resist or to even sabotage the explicitly directed public policies of their organizations in defiance of their superiors. And toward the end of her talk, she took some questions from the audience.
So I very much enjoyed your presentation, but I wanted to go back to the question of the Japanese writing the visas for Jews as opposed to somebody else writing visas for Nazis escaping Europe in 1945. I'm making that up, obviously. But and so to what extent is there a kind of another dimension of a moral claim? That is, do you simply say, yes, there are good guys and bad guys doing this, or do you simply say there might be a way of evaluating, which you kind of laid out a little bit about conflicts and laws or agencies? Are you coming up with a set of criteria that takes care of the county clerk blocking gay marriages? Or how do you, I mean, do you do enough to kind of come up with the criteria about who works, who's doing the right thing, and who's doing the bad thing?
Mm-hmm. Great question. Do I do enough? I'm sure I don't do enough. And I welcome other ideas, other criteria, things that people should weigh as they make these decisions. And I think the county clerk denying marriage certificates for gay couples is a great example. That's that person to thine own self be true. She could not look at herself in the mirror and issue that certificate, even though it was a huge violation of law. And I think the majority of people in the United States were appalled at that action. Well, let me, if I might, throw it back to you. What other criteria do you think people should weigh before they do this?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that's entirely fair to throw it back to me. But, but on that larger point, you might say there are various accords that this country and others are signed to relating to human rights, or there are various agreements, international agreements. Mm-hmm. To what extent could you be acting not in reference just to your own country, but to a broader conception of international agreements? Mm-hmm. Would that be a factor you would take into account?
Absolutely, and I think Waldo would agree when he talked about obligation to laws, and those would include international laws. So definitely, in fact, the way we kind of teach ethics, a lot of it is compliance with law. But then the question is, if you're in those gray areas where you might be in compliance with law, but is it the right thing to do? And whose ethics do you choose to move forward on that? Yeah. Great question.
All right, my name is Alex Ballou. I am a environmental studies and political science double major. So some of the examples you provided were super interesting, and thank you so much for this talk. It just seemed through your examples, it seems like at least the majority of your examples were based on environmental policy.
Yes.
Do you see this form of dissent, the guerrilla government, as a whole, just like the majority is environmentally based, or is that just in your examples?
Great question. So my first career was as an environmental attorney and for the state of Kansas as a water attorney, and then I went into administration. So I have always felt that I understand, even though Dick Bauer might disagree, I at least try very hard to keep up to speed on environmental policies, environmental issues, and the science behind it. So I feel more comfortable with those issues than I would health policy, for example, or international policy, which is why I gravitated towards this in the first place. Does this happen outside the environmental arena? Yes, it does. I think Private Manning is an example. I've been contacted by people in healthcare who have talked about this. And in fact, I have been urged to add more cases from different policy areas and also to internationalize this to do some comparative work to see how it pans out in different countries. I do think that there's, I could be wrong here, here's a hypothesis, that there's, this would be more likely to happen in an environmental setting than a tax setting. I'm married to an economist who very by the numbers. I respect economists. I'm not slamming economists, but it doesn't tug at his heart the way a lot of my environmental students say. He wouldn't talk about right or wrong in terms of economics. He would run the regression analysis and then say, here's what the numbers say. Scientists do that too, and at the same time, I think there's the context of environmental policy, energy policy is one that that people care very deeply about and can cause very deep sentiments that might make it more likely that this behavior would occur. Do you agree or disagree?
I agree. I just have two examples for you, too, that you're saying. And you're saying you're asking for examples. Really.
Yes.
Have you heard of Herman Daly or Joseph Stiglitz?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
I just figured I'd offer that as an example.
Yeah.
Cool.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Michaela Lehman. I am a biology major here at the University of Utah. And I was wondering, in the realm of science, a lot of the time, innovation really happens when an undergraduate or someone underneath the principal investigator does something that the principal investigator doesn't really want them to do. Like they follow a line of investigation that the principal investigator was either abandoning or not focused on. And so in the realm of science or like culinary innovation, business innovation, should some form of guerrilla dissent be encouraged? What is your opinion on that?
Good question. I think this idea of listening, even though it's so simple, you know, everybody can listen. I think this idea of deep listening, active listening, really listening to people who have ideas that are not like yours is very important. You talk about it from the scientific perspective. One recent setting at the University of Kansas level has to do with the diversity dialogue on campus, and which has been very strong and very fierce and I think very positive, because the administrators said, we're going to listen. We're going to listen and give us a little bit of time to figure out what steps we're going to take. But they listened. They didn't shut them down. They didn't say, oh, that'll never work. They listened and had an open door policy for weeks and weeks and weeks with many, many different forums. And I think that's step one. And I worry about people who don't listen. Or I think we as professors are trained, lawyers for sure, to argue right back. Oh, that'll never work. Oh, that'll never work. I always say that collaborative problem solving with professors is a nightmare, because we all have to show that we're the smartest person in the room. And how do you do it? You say, oh, that'll never work. But here's my idea. Here's my idea. I think it's relearning behavior to listen. And you don't have to, in the end, agree. You don't have, in the end, have to follow policies that are suggested. But if you don't listen, you're not even getting to step one. And I would think, if I were a scientific researcher, I would encourage you to come up with different ideas, different ways of operating. It, to me, that would only improve the scientific method in your research. Does that make sense?
That will have to be our last question, but please join me in thanking Dr. O'Leary for an excellent forum.
Thank you.
This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, your humble curator and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.